Welcome to episode 117 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including the Virtual Boy. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uessa. Hello.
Hello, Mark. I think 117 is a Halo number, right? We've come full circle.
It's Master Chief's serial code. Yeah, that's right.
That's right, yeah. So, how are you, Mark? Lots of things to talk about today.
Sure, I was just having some hardware issues, so sorry for holding you up there.
Live updates for Tech Talk, yeah.
Yeah, I'll have a little bit more Tech Talk to continue on later on. So, yeah, why don't we roll into it?
Sure. I mean, I'm sure we could talk a bunch about the Nintendo Direct news this last week. I know we've both got thoughts on that. I think by the time this episode comes out, not a lot of people will necessarily care. I was curious if you're actually interested in the Virtual Boy coming to Nintendo Online, though.
Yeah, I have always been vaguely interested in the Virtual Boy. Obviously, it came and went at the time. I wasn't interested enough to even consider buying it, the real thing. I guess it would have been a collector's item if I did get it. I did check out like the vision for it at the Nintendo Museum when I was there
right,
in Kyoto a few months ago. And it was interesting enough, but the sheer darkness of it just seems like painful to the eye.
Very intense red just beaming straight into your eyeballs, yeah.
Yeah, but if it was at home and they have like a Labo-style cardboard version
where
you can get the full-on...
Labo's back, baby.
Yeah, you can get the full-on plastic accessory to plug your original Switch or your Switch 2 into, so I might give it a whirl depending on the price. Of course, they haven't announced that price yet.
Yeah, I probably won't. It seems like a very niche product unless you've got a specific nostalgia for it. It was cool to see them specifically shouting out the Nintendo Museum, which you were talking about recently, though.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't see, obviously, the new Wing. I think it's going to be dedicated towards like artwork and pre-production art, concept art, which I think is fantastic. Obviously, you have a commercial artist in your family, so you know how kind of intensive and how critical that is towards any production, especially video games in the early stages.
Excellent.
So it'd be great to show that off.
Yes. Yeah, I'd love to get there one day. Okay, so we've got three courses of games to talk about today. So in the appetizer, talking about some game-related topics. So today, coming in hot with something that I only learned about a couple of days ago, and that I attended yesterday, was called the Full Indie Summit here in Vancouver. So this is a group who hosts sort of monthly meetups and networking events and things, but once a year hosts this big summit for a bunch of talks, kind of like an indie equivalent to the GDC, on a much smaller scale, obviously. So I tagged along there, not knowing exactly what to expect and how technical it would be, but it was interesting to see that there was about 10 talks over the course of the day, and they ranged in sort of focusing on technical aspects to games, creative design elements, and also just the cultural business behind game studios. So a pretty wide berth there, and they were largely scoped towards sort of everyday neophytes like me who aren't necessarily immersed in the game development scene. So it was pretty accessible. So that was interesting to check out. So I was just going to chat out a couple of things I saw there. There were a few booths of indie devs showing off their games as well. But there was sort of 10 talks. I caught all but just a couple of those. There was one on accessibility by Alex Carey, who was basically just going through the various aspects of accessibility in games. And I mean, these were all only 20-minute talks. They were fairly surface level somewhat, but a good primer to all these various topics. So this was talking through the various ways in which games can approach accessibility for whether it's visual impairment or auditory impairment. Curiously covering cognitive impairments and how games can approach that as an example was Wilmot's Warehouse, which I talked about recently, talking how that is basically all about organizing games, but from a player, like, there's no correct answer in that game. It's all letting the player come up with their own technique and with a flexible approach of how they're going to organize their thoughts and to approach the game. So that was interesting, talking through how, like, in trying to approach accessibility, they can actually create limitations, which encourages innovation in games, that can, like, restrict games in a way that actually can focus their their intent a little more, perhaps. So that was quite interesting. There was one by Gordon McLattery on basically building sustainable game studios that I found quite interesting. He was comparing it to like industrial farming, and like you've got the concept of finite games that have like a clear beginning and end versus infinite games that have like, you know, games as services basically that you're meant to be playing forever. But how businesses can be basically have that same model, whereas they can be designed for a finite range of success, but like once they're basically burning themselves out, and that you've seen so many studio closures, and trying to build a game studio for an infinite business model to, you know, encourage long-term success, and basically how you can utilize employees' various skills and, you know, growing slowly rather than just growth at all costs. So there was some interesting suggestions there to see a more sustainable, friendly studio that's going to survive, hopefully, in the indie space. Yeah, so that's obviously a passionate topic for indie game devs. That particular talk got a standing ovation at the end, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Yeah, that's really cool. I noticed you sent me that invite pretty last moment, and I saw that it was a more developer-oriented talk, so I didn't end up going. But, you know, I've been in the tech industry here in Vancouver over many years. I've been to a few of those before, and I recall how kind of energized you can feel. You get used to your doldrums of your day to day, and then you get some other really smart people together in a small area, change of venue, and you talk about more kind of inspiring topics, and it really does like give you more juice to go back to your workplace and kind of try out some new techniques. So I'm glad to hear that something like that was going on locally here.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I did have to push myself to go to that, not knowing anyone. It was a very overstimulating event, long day, a lot of noise, but definitely engaging and exciting to see some new perspectives, and especially the breadth of creativity that the local design scene is offering up. I just wanted to share that one other quick talk from Marina Ryan, who was talking through adaptive music and games. And I mean, this might seem obvious to some, but basically talking through the various ways in which music can be layered, both horizontally or vertically, basically like adding in new instrumental layers or bridging to new musical tracks, and the various ways in which games can do that. That was exciting because she was playing a lot of examples, which was giving a clear sense of how those operate. And of course, it was a good excuse to play some of the music from Nier Automata, which of course is a great example of that.
A classic game. I really got to play that, the other Nier game. I forget the name of it.
Nier Replicants. Yeah, I played through I finished that game, but finishing it once is like barely scratching the surface, obviously.
Right. That's the game where it only really starts at the ending.
Yes, yeah. So I just wanted to quickly talk through a couple of games I actually played there briefly. It was interesting to see that mobility games were big. There was quite a few that were about sort of running, wall jumping, running parkour style games. I played one called Project Haste, which was basically a multiplayer shooter that felt very much like Oops or Lucio's from Overwatch, where you're basically grinding on the walls and shooting at each other. There was one called Momentum, which was a sort of time trial parkour game. I think Neon White is probably a close example that's been big lately. It's not my sort of game, to be honest. Like, time trials just don't hold much appeal to me, but like I can obviously there's a huge market for that. I can see that being quite appealing, and everything is cats. You're like jumping and climbing on giant like cat climbing trees for some reason, but it was a cute concept.
Yeah, first person platforming is not really ever a genre that I've sought out, but 3D platforming can be done well. I think third person works better, though. I think recent examples like the Zelda games, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, obviously do it really successfully. So first person I'm still not sure about. Yeah, there is still something very exciting about being able to execute a really precisely set up challenge. I recall in the Jedi Survivor, I think it was, there were some pretty devious optional platforming challenges that really made you use every technique at your disposal and had me kind of pulling my hair out for a while there.
Well, these are really quite high-speed, thrilling, like, first-person experiences. So you really want to be in the, like, immersed in that parkour experience, I guess, for these sorts of games.
Yeah, I think there is a game that's all about kind of kinetic, I guess, action called, like, Mullet Mad Jack. It's this kind of boomer shooter themed cyberpunk-ish action game where it's all about getting to the next like time bubble increase so that you right. can get a little bit further, and all about the FPS genre. So yeah, just about kineticism, I guess.
Obviously you've got Mirror's Edge, classic sort of parkour right. game that's more narrative focused. Something else I noticed curiously is that there was a designer there basically showcasing a Roblox game that she designed. It was called Hatch and Craft. It was basically a dinosaur Minecraft style game, and like I was just curious to see. I don't know much about Roblox. I've not played it. I'm trying to avoid my daughter from sort of experiencing that world at this point, but like I don't want to gatekeep, you know, those designers. Obviously they are absolutely real designers in that space, and it's curious to see Roblox as basically a game engine that's somewhat accessible for new game designers to come in without a lot of technical experience and showcase some cool ideas.
Yeah, Roblox is an interesting phenomenon. You know, my kid, my oldest kid has played it on and off, but I have memories of it from, you know, like a long time ago, many, many years when my nephews were quite a bit younger. They're you know, graduated adults now, but it has always been a platform for like game creation.
Mm.
And sort of empowering children, or at least that's how they sell it as, of course. And then, you know, you do things like watch the People Make Games videos about the kind of, there's two of them, I think, about kind of the exploitative practices going on there. I'm not an expert. I just know that it's a deeper issue than just a play place.
Well, there's plenty to critique about Roblox as a system and how they exploit their creators, but that's nothing to say, like, that's nothing to critique the creators themselves, who I'm sure are doing some fascinating work within that realm.
Yeah, and having just a platform like that, despite its ethics or whatnot, it's impressive to see what people can create and share when you create a platform for people to share.
Just quickly, one final game I wanted to shout out is, with all of the card-based roguelite games we've seen out there, I'm surprised I have not seen this before, but it was basically a roguelite trick-taking game, which obviously trick-taking are undergoing a huge renaissance in the board game space. I've not actually seen a digital game attempt to emulate that. Obviously, there are some challenges to... like, trick-taking is all about the various parties, and you want multiple players to sort of shift up the dynamics there. This was a fairly simplified version of that. You're basically playing against an opponent, and they're playing three cards against your one card. So it's a much simplified version. I'm curious to see how they play with those and escalate the mechanics. Like, I only played the tutorial, which was fairly simple, but talking to one of the designers there, they do have a lot of other ideas of how they're going to evolve that. There is a demo, I should say the name, it is called Hands of Hell, which they described as basically Bellatro versus Hades. You're going into the underworld and playing against the various levels of hell, and it is marketing as a narrative experience though, which is also quite interesting, more likely to have me play it. And was curious to see how like you can use these simple game mechanics with like a regular deck of cards to express story and narrative in some fascinating ways, and using these cards as a sort of language. And I think that's something you're going to be talking about perhaps in a game later today.
Just so. I have a narrative-based card game to discuss for my main topic. But that's for a few courses from now. Any more items you want to talk about from the conference?
No, I'll hand over to you for your appetizer.
Really cool. All right, so mine is fairly short. It's not really news per se. It's just something that I've been working on recently. Last episode, I did a kind of a hardware showcase where I showed off some mobile handhelds. This time around, I'm going to be talking about software. I'm going to be talking about Linux specifically, and I know that Linux has been around forever. It's really mature now, and many people use it quite a lot, especially because, you know, some of these PC handhelds, gaming PC handhelds like Steam Deck, use Linux as a core. So that was, I guess, one of my earlier experiences with it. I did dabble a little bit on desktop computers. You know, I've been an experimenter for many years now, built my own PCs, reinstalled Windows dozens of times, and then tried out early versions of Linux. But it's really been on and off. Recently, though, I got it in my head that I wanted to do a little bit more tinkering. You know that I enjoy hardware tinkering. I decided that I would, I wanted to make a NAS, which is a network accessible storage device. So I was thinking about, you know, pulling one of my hard drives out of my gaming PC, because I have too many drives in there and I'm not using them effectively. So I thought, hey, this is not my primary drive, so it'll be no problem pulling it out. And then I pulled it out and just the primary drive would not work properly. Tried to reinstall Windows, and then it was asking me for these drivers, these hardware drivers, which I've never experienced before. I've always worked out just fine without it. But anyways, a little bit frustrated. And this made me think, well, you know, why don't I give Linux a shot? Because I'm already curious about it. I know
so brave, Mark.
There are some really cool versions and cool flavors out there. And some of them that are much more directly meant to support gaming PCs, PC gaming. Because what is a Steam Deck if not a gaming PC? So most of the advancement has been coming, I wouldn't say most, but a really strong component of the advancement of Linux as a gaming platform has been from Valve itself. So I think they're pretty critical in either, I don't know if they created it initially, but they heavily support this software layer called Proton. And Proton is essentially a kind of a translation language that enables Windows-only games to run on Linux operating systems.
It's kind of like a sort of emulation layer, I guess, or
in
maybe
a,
not.
In a way, I don't know. I don't know the actual technology behind it. It just helps translate some like technical libraries that are necessary to run these things. So sure, you can call it kind of like an interpreter that lets Linux machines speak Windows in terms of gaming. And it really has become quite seamless now. Well, there's kind of two steps to ultimate adoption of Linux as a viable gaming hardware. Is either developers make games for Linux, which a few are. A few are doing that actively, and it's noticeable. It's getting stronger and stronger. A few major publishers are doing it, and then there's smaller platforms like I was noticing GOG recently has a lot of classic games that run in native Linux. So putting that aside, the vast majority of games still only support Windows operating system, not Mac or Linux.
So what's the benefit of Linux if you're just going to use it to emulate Windows anyway?
Well, I'm not emulating Windows. I'm running in the Linux operating system, and I have all the software and all the UI and all the different workflow that you can use from using an alternative operating system. The translation layer is applied directly on a game-per-game basis.
Right.
I'm not running Windows within Linux, right? So if you're thinking about traditional emulation, it's not that.
No, I know that. But like, what do you see as the key benefit of using Linux in the first place?
The key benefit is that you don't have to pay a software license.
True.
You're also not being spied upon by dozens and dozens of intrusive softwares that are either pre-installed by Microsoft itself, so forcing you to upgrade to Copilot or MS-365 or whatever it's called now.
My wife's literally trying to fight through Windows, trying to force an update to Windows 11 right now. So
there you go. So you're really beholden to a lot of what Microsoft forces you to do on their platform, even on your old computer. And then beyond that, a lot of hardware manufacturers that make Windows devices add their own bloatware and spyware on top of the PCs that you buy. And if you're not very picky or you're not very savvy, then you'll probably just let those spywares run on you, let those bloatwares run on your computers. And those are ultimately dragging down the machine's performance. And if it's an old aging device, maybe that every little ounce of performance that could be freed up is something that you want. And what Linux lets you do is you can run with as much software pre-built in as you want or as little as you want. So you can finally tune it to the way that you want. In fact, you can do a lot of gaming on Linux, you know, without things like Steam. You can just use alternative platforms. So you have a lot more choice and you have a lot more control. And that's the primary advantage of using an alternate software OS. And primarily, you don't have to pay that Windows license. So all the better.
You don't have that ease of use, and you have to fight for that control and like, you know, wrest it from the computer and trying to navigate the operating system for yourself,
It really depends. So there are a lot of flavors of Linux, and that's what scares off a lot of people. Is, well, you know, if there's one flavor of Windows, right? Well, sometimes there's two. There's like this Pro or that XP or whatever, this and that. But there's like thousands of flavors of Linux, and every group is trying to tell you that their flavor is the best. Well, the point is, the long and the short of it is that there's a best version for each usage, and there's probably two or three competing distros or distributions of Linux for a given use case. So getting back on track, there are a couple that are specifically oriented towards PC gaming. One of them is called Bazite. The advantage of that is that it's there are versions of Bazite that are specifically tuned to run on handhelds. So before SteamOS was officially supported on Windows hardware like the Lenovo Legion Go, Bazite was a really smart solution. Now, the official SteamOS is available on Lenovo Legion Go, which is my portable gaming PC, and I've actually switched over. I gave up Windows entirely, moved over to SteamOS, and I'm so happy for it. It's just a way more streamlined experience. Nobara is another one. There's a lot of different flavors. Ultimately, for my gaming PC, I was having some issues, so I ended up going with Ubuntu, like classic. Ubuntu is kind of like the kind of vanilla of Linux, and it's well supported for a bunch of different reasons. And it's as difficult to set up as like Windows 10 is. So like you have to start it, and you have to check a few boxes, and you have to enter your username and a password, and wait about 15 minutes, and then you're set up. So that's as complex as it is. If you have set up, installed an operating system before, like Windows XP or 10 or 11, then it's just as easy to do any version, any popular version of Linux these days. So I would say that people really shouldn't be concerned about the technical difficulty of it. It's super easy now.
It does sound like they're a little somewhat specialized, though. Like if you have a specialized device dedicated to one use case, like games or editing, for example, it might be more useful than having a broad multi-use device.
Yeah, well, you have those choices. There are platforms. I think there's Ubuntu Studio, for instance, that's set up for like audio and video producers, for instance. So those specific use cases are met. Generally, most people are going to, unless they're working for a company or using it for their own business, are probably going to be multi-use case users like myself. My primary PC is PC gaming plus podcasting. Why am I not? Funny enough, I'm not using that computer right now because there is a hitch in using some Linux distros is that driver support is not always there for hardware. And I was having some issues with my video, my camera. But my mic works great. The same mic is working on all those different platforms. And there's drivers for my video card. No problem there. So, you know, you're going to have run into a couple extra steps. But I'm still enjoying it. I've been running Ubuntu for a few days now. And it's setting it up the way I like to. And unlike Windows, I can do things like assign my taskbar to the left or the right side of the screen. Because you used to be able to do that in Windows 10, but not anymore. Windows 11 decided you don't need that. You don't need that level of control. Windows knows better. So just a few little details like that. Exactly. So that's been my little journey. Now I have no PCs running Windows in my house. And I'm not displeased about that. So if I run into major problems in the future, I'll be sure to let you guys know.
Well, you're a braver man than me. We know you're a bit of a tinkerer. I do not have the patience for trying to figure these things out and trying to blaze those trails myself. So, yeah.
Not that hard. Thousands of developers and enthusiasts have done it before me. I just took the extra step this time. And yeah, once again, if anyone has any questions, just feel free to reach out to me. I can tell you about all the half dozen Linux distros I tried out before this one.
Awesome. Okay, we're ready for the main course.
Yeah, let's do it. Do you want to talk about your game or should I start?
Why don't you keep the momentum going there?
Yeah, sure. So we were talking about little card games, roguelites, or card-themed games, and that's a type of game I want to be talking about today. This game's from 2022, and it's called Card Shark. So this is a game that I had, a little bit of an eye on. It's a smaller game published by Devolver Digital, and it's developed by a group called Nariel. And it is an action-adventure game with some puzzle elements, some card game elements, but this is not a card game. So this is not a roguelike. This is not a poker simulator. This is a game about games of chance. So first of all, this game is set in historical France. So it's set in the 18th century. And there are many characters in this game. And a lot of them are actual historical figures. So Louis XV, the Musketeer Henri d'Aramitz, the great author Voltaire, are actually characters that are featured in the story of this game, Card Shark. Yeah. You play as this kind of servant boy. I actually forget his name even. He doesn't talk very much because he is a mute individual.
Designed not to be noticed. Yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely noticed. He's your kind of avatar, of course, and he has personality, but he doesn't speak. So you get involved with this gregarious character, this ne'er-do-well sort of rogue called the Comte de Saint-Germain. So the Count of Saint-Germain, of course, this is what you're led to believe is that he's a fake noble. He pretends to be a noble. And essentially he goes around various places in France and tries to bilk people of their money. And this character takes you on as their kind of protege. So I told you this game is not a card game, but it will help if you know about card games. So if you know about poker, if you played Bellagio before, better if you played actual poker with human beings. But it goes into other areas it talks about other games of chance, like three-card Monty, even coin flipping. Things like that. So it's not just about cards.
You are actually playing card games in this, though, right?
You are not playing card games.
Okay.
So let me make that quite clear.
Interesting. Okay.
You are in situations where your character is playing card games.
But the game itself is abstracted?
It is showing you a point of view, right? Mm. And the metaphor is not playing an entire game of cards. So let me just break it down even further. So we know the setting. You're this poor peasant boy, and you're being taught by the fake noble, the Comte de Saint-Germain, and you get involved with various individuals, like itinerant Romani individuals. The Romani characters are actually treated fairly well. They're some of the more interesting characters in the story. And you run into a lot of nobles as well, because nobles, they have a lot of money, and they're good marks for bilking cash out of. So what does the game end up being like? Basically, there are these encounters, and you eventually, after the tutorial, you're given a map of France. And there's four locations on the map of France. You know, this map, it actually reminded me quite a bit of the overworld map of that other European set game, historical game we played recently called Pentiment.
Of course. Right?
Unlike that game was set in Bavaria, this one is set in France. But it is very similar in other ways as well. It's a highly narrative story. It has a very distinctive 2D art style. So if you enjoyed Pentiment, you have an interest in history and historical fiction, this game is very appealing. And that's kind of what drew me in. So what is it like in each of those encounters? So you choose a location on the map, and then the count is taking you to, a manor house. It's taking you to an inn. It's taking you to a different scenario. And he's introducing you to other characters. Thus, the story kind of evolves. And he says, all right, here's the plan. We're going to try the trick called the elusive hand or something like that. So he explains to you a real-world card cheating technique. And I'm not an expert in this, but these are all real techniques or
ace up the sleeve,
real seeming techniques,
right?
And he basically shows you how to execute it. And those techniques you're supposed to memorize and repeat and execute. And the way you execute them is done through a wide range of quick time events.
Right. Okay.
What is your feeling about quick time events, Daniel?
I mean, they have their place, shall we say. I'm not opposed to them. They can become a little bit of a crutch in game design, but they can be utilized for like engagement, I guess, in a narrative sense, to just at least make that you feel like you're having some input. I mean, I've talked about like recently as Alien Isolation last episode that had various like what are basically quick time events for mini games, but were utilized there for immersion. So that they can be used well.
Right. So my experience for QuickTime events, if the listener is not familiar, goes all the way back to a game called Shenmue. So Shenmue was a game for Sega Dreamcast. It's been released on PC since, PlayStation as well. And basically, if you can picture it, you might see like some sort of action sequence happening on screen. And then at a certain moment, you have to really quickly press the B button, or you have to tap the A button, or you have to click down on the right stick or something like that. So there's lots of games that do this. Actually, I think a lot of DS games were built like this as
well. Heavy Rain and the other games from Quantic Dream come to mind.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, there's lots of examples throughout. And this one is a lot of the time the QuickTime events are led by you. It's just like if you want to pull down a group of cards as you're shuffling, it's pulling. I think it's literally called pulling down. You pull down on the left stick. And then if you want to do something called, I think it's called insetting or jigging or something like that, you press right on the stick. So,
and is this in real time?
This is you. Well, you get to do it. You get to do it at your own pace while you're practicing. Because in front of, before all of these encounters, you're allowed to practice with your mentor, with the count. And you can do this practice as many times as you want to. And I found myself actually repeating a lot of these sequences many, 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 many times just to get it right.
It was like sort of setting up for a heist and the practice run.
Yeah, really very much so. Because obviously you're engaging in crimes. You're engaging in a sort of fraud, right? You're trying to steal from people. One of the hardest activities in this game is throwing cards in a hat. So you have to sit like 2 meters away from a hat that's set up on a chair, and you have to toss it just right timing and get it inside the hat. And you don't know why you're being taught this technique, but it actually comes up in a later sequence, but in the middle of a sort of encounter with a card game. So essentially, what you're seeing is the setting is a narrative encounter in a space with new and interesting characters. Sometimes the characters repeat. Sometimes the characters are actively suspicious of you. Sometimes the characters don't know you're cheating them and you're trying to prevent them from finding out. Sometimes the characters know you're cheating them and they're really curious about you and they want to see it more. Or they want to have you bilk their frenemies of their cash. So before long, you succeed at the early encounters. You're really being inundated by this whole range of different techniques. And it's actually really draining on your mental state, because you just memorize this sequence to let you pull off this one sort of trick, like the three-card Monty. And you got it in your head. It's all working well. And then the next encounter has the count teaching you an entirely different technique for cheating at a game. Beyond that, the game gets more and more, as the game proceeds, they have you building upon these techniques. And they're using these techniques in sequence and playing them out so that some of these encounters have you utilizing maybe like 4 or 5 of the various techniques you've learned in the past.
Do you always know which ones you need to use in advance, or is the game trying to figure out which one is applicable?
You don't know.
Okay.
Here's the thing you don't know, is the count will try and prepare you as much as possible. He will tell you exactly what's going on in the early missions. But some of the missions get so involved that just like a
heist. Plan goes wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. The plan can go sideways. Mm. There's a literal case where you are being held at gunpoint and you're having to play a card game with someone pointing a gun at you and your master. So obviously you have to improvise. So that's where that card throwing technique came in. I thought I was being taught just to pass time or something like that. But I actually had to, in the middle of a card game sequence, my opponent that was holding a gun at me stood up from his seat and I had to quickly throw a certain card under his butt
before he sat down.
So, and it did not prepare me for doing that. It just brought up the interface and I had to do a split second to do it. And I had to remember that I got taught that in the past. So this game prepares you and it doesn't prepare you. You have to be on your toes. Mm. And I think that's what's going to maybe turn off some people from playing this game. So far, I've told you about a lot of interesting things about this game, the historical setting. I haven't told you that about the art style. It's really, really compelling. It's colorful. It's impressionistic. The background paintings are particularly lovely. The characters stand out actually a little bit from that. They're a little bit more cartoony. The characters are done more like woodblock prints, but they're like lovingly animated. The story is really interesting. The characters are well researched. The music is quite nice. Mostly it's just kind of like really kind of era appropriate sort of vamping music, but at times like familiar. Like Mozart refrain will come up. Like I think they were playing music from the.
Can you use that all that public license, you know, time appropriate music.
It's perfect. Yeah, it's perfect. So all of that is fantastic, and I can't get enough of it. You know, if you love that the movie Mozart, no Amadeus, that's what it's called. Mm. You'll really enjoy this one. But this is a game I think for. I can think of a kind of a rude way to say it, but it's for a certain type of brain.
Goes.
Yeah, a certain type of brain, a certain type of mind that likes really intricate, multi-step rules. Maybe you like setting up dominoes or card towers or things like that, but you have to have a very precise mind, and I don't really. So I have a challenge in executing some of these higher level chapters. At least you have one or two ways to kind of adjust the levers. So essentially in all of these card game encounters, you have an opponent. So the people you're bilking out of their cash typically, and they start out really not suspicious of you. But if you raise the bet, the initial bet, there's always a bet because it depends what your payout is. You might not play a full game. But if you've executed your technique and you win, then you will get that payout. So you get to choose what the initial bet is going to be. And if you keep it low, then their suspicion is low. But if you raise the bet a decent amount, then their suspicion starts higher. So say it starts at 30% instead of starting at 10%. And then as the time ticks, as you're trying to execute your cheating techniques, if you take too long, then the suspicion meter gets higher and higher and higher. So you can adjust the difficulty slightly, but mostly it's on you to execute those techniques effectively and quickly.
That sounds quite dynamic, but I'm curious though, you talk about like the plan going bad. What is the fail state here? Because I don't mean like stealth games, for example, that can be a big downside to like these hard in-state, oh, you got caught, reset, go back 5 minutes and try again. Like, does it solve that issue?
It does. It does in an interesting way. It's a bit of a spoiler to say that. I will say thematically what it is ultimately you're trying to cheat people of their money. So the measure of success is having a lot of money, and the measure of failure is not having a lot of money. So you can get to a state where you either lose all your money, or more likely what's going to happen is people find out that you're cheating and they either jail you, at which point you can go to jail, you can get fined, or you can get executed.
Okay. That's definitely a fail state. Yep.
This is the 18th century. You can either get shot by a noble and their guards, or you could get stabbed by a street, you know, peasant that you cheated at three card Monty.
No, no accountability. Right? Voltaire takes a dislike to you, I guess.
Right. But Let me just say that in an interesting fashion, death is not the end. There is a way to get back in the game, and it doesn't involve save scumming. You cannot save scum in this game. There's only one save file. Huh. And depending on how badly your game goes, they'll actually erase your save file.
Oh, well. Okay.
So, I don't know. Would you call that a roguelike?
I mean, yes, but it depends on how long a playthrough is. There's been a couple of games that have played with that. I can't bring to mind the name. It was a game where if you die X number of times, it's basically done. And like for a 10-hour game, though, I really don't want to be playing with that friction.
Yeah, I would not call this like straight out a roguelike, but it has qualities of roguelikes. And in a sense, let's just say it reminds me a little bit of Hades in some cases.
Interesting. Okay.
Right. So this game is interesting a lot in different ways. It has 28 techniques, cheating techniques in all. I've only learned 13 of them, so I'm about halfway through the game.
And that's not applicable long. To like a wide number of games, right? It's not all just one.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. One encounter might include like 5 or 6 of those techniques all in one. And then there's also these kind of free play encounters where you're just kind of playing with the regulars and you're allowed to choose one of 3 different techniques to use. And of course, you're going to choose the one that you're the best at, right? Mm. Because some of them are just a lot easier than others. Some of them require like just split second, like, you know, peeking at a player's hand while you're filling their glass of wine. And it's really, you have no time at all. Some of them, you just need to seek out the highest card, not so hard. Other times you're trying to find out the number of instances of the most frequent suit. It's much harder to count at a glance. The other things that are difficult is, I told you about the quick time events. If you're like me and you play on a variety of different platforms, just being able to know where the A button is hard sometimes.
Mm-mm.
Of course, if you play on Nintendo versus
switching
Sony,
from Xbox to Nintendo Xbox. Is my daughter is like, why is the A button here?
trips me up a lot. And so that's going to work against you. Of course, if you only play on Switch, that's not a problem. Oh, I didn't say that this game is on Mac, Windows, and Nintendo Switch, not the other platforms for some reason. Okay, I've said a bunch of things. I forgot that there is actually a meta plot to this game. The Comte de Saint-Germain, who is your mentor, is trying to seek out the meaning of this rumor going around. And the rumor is called the 12 bottles of milk. And it sounds ridiculous, but he keeps talking about it and he keeps asking people. And some people know what it is. And the references, they say, how's the
milk opium or something?
I can't tell you anything. So the story develops and develops. It actually goes to kind of some shocking places.
Okay.
So I would say that this game succeeds as a narrative game. It's very interesting mechanically. I would not say that the mechanics are going to be appealing to everyone. I think it's well worth a try. This game could probably be had for cheap. I think I probably got it on a game bundle or something like that. But go check it out. You know, Devolver Digital does some really interesting stuff. And if you like historical games, card-based games, games with really interesting mechanics, then I think this game is a winner. And it's only like 8 hours or something to beat. So I think I will try and keep at it if I don't get too frustrated by these really devious sequences of card trickery. It's not for the faint of heart.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm definitely curious to check that out, especially just to see how it plays with that meta structure of games, basically.
Very cool.
Sorry, right, my animals are fighting. I don't know what they're doing up there.
Oh, I know how that is. All right, would you like to go?
Yes, yeah. So we don't often talk about the new hotness here. It's not usually our focus, but I'd be remiss to skip the opportunity to talk about Silksong, the indie darling that, of course, everyone is talking about. I have been playing, and I mean, it's harder for us to talk about new games, partly not having Game Pass, partly being unemployed, but I mean, this game is remarkably cheap for a new game that with a lot of work has been, you know, they've been working on for, you know, 7-8 years. I don't want to necessarily have the discussion as to whether that's a good or a bad price, whether it's good or bad for the industry. It's a whole other business talk a separate discussion to be had. But yeah, I've been playing Silksong, obviously the sequel to Hollow Knight by Team Cherry. Mark, have you played Hollow Knight?
I have played Hollow Knight, and I think it's one of the good ones. I like Metroidvania games. I don't play a lot of Metroidvania games aside from, you know, the Metroids. I really like this one Metroidvania that was on Xbox 360 called Shadow Complex.
Oh, yes, that's another one.
We don't really talk about it because it's based on a terrible author's story. But mechanically, it was a great game by this developer, Chair. Had some cool 2.5D elements. And I really like the latest 2D roguelite Prince of Persia based
game. Yes, that's one that comes to mind a lot. Yeah. Playing Silksong.
That one's really cool. And of course, Metroid Dread is also cool in an interesting way. Also, I haven't gotten that far into Hollow Knight, but I played, you know, a dozen hours of it. Mm. I know how attractive the art style is and kind of how precise the platforming is. Really quite cool.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed that one a lot. I recall 100%ing it and doing all possible content up until the point I got to the final boss and just realized this isn't going to happen. I could throw myself at this wall for 10 hours and eventually get there, sure, but I don't particularly want to, and just quit right there. So it does have a particularly abrasive approach to difficulty that a lot of people will draw comparisons to the Souls-like genre here, obviously. There's been some debate as to whether this counts as a Souls-like game, which I'll get to, but yeah, I struggled with Hollow Knight. This was a number of years ago, so I don't remember a lot of the specifics in terms of figuring out the exact comparisons between Silksong and Hollow Knight. Oh, this one has the health regeneration is slightly different, or the attack animations are slightly different. You get pretty granular to figure out the exact differences, and I'm not familiar enough with to make that point. So I would largely be judging Silksong on its own, that is to say. So, I mean, it is obviously a Metroidvania. You're playing as Hornet. Everything is kind of a bug or bug-like creature in this game. Beautifully 2D animated, I will say up front. Everything is crisp. And, like, the bug designs, so many of the characters have these, like, white masks, basically. It just creates this excellent contrast that makes everything really easy to read, especially, you know, your player character. Really crisp and easy to read animations, attack animations and tells, for example, the bosses are really well telegraphed. That's something that's been a big issue in a lot of these games lately, is just these, you know, big hulking monstrosities, long wind-ups, and it's really hard to read tells in games lately, I've been finding, where this does that really well. The animation is really clean. There's just so many tiny little touches in that animation, like the way Hornet will sort of do this little backstep as she turns around and changes direction, or when you flip and there's this backflip at the exact crescendo of a jump. So many lovely little touches, and that have obviously put, you know, so much work into this. The time has been worth it. A lot of polish in that regard, so I can't really fault that.
How many years has it been? Like 7 or 8?
7 or 8 years, I seem to recall. Yeah. So overall, the structure, I mean, I think Hollow Knight was largely you were digging down in underground. Silksong, you go up. It's basically you've been abducted by some kind of cultists to go into a city. You escape and you're trying to figure out why, what was going on here. So it's a little bit of a mystery. The story is a little vague. It's a similar sort of From Software Souls-like sort of gothic vibes. Everything's just very haunted and dreary. There are a lot of lovely little character beats along the way. You're helping like other characters that you come across, and there's this real sense that Hornet is trying to help people and you know, just trying to do the right thing and helping these people survive, basically. But most of the characters you come across are all pilgrims, and there's this real sense of everyone making the pilgrimage, making the climb, which works thematically, obviously. It does create some interesting analogues to, like, obviously, this sort of penance, almost that difficulty being some kind of, like, active self-flagellation in that players are, like, forcing themselves through all these difficult challenges. And it's almost religious fervor that some players seem to treat difficulty as an inherently good thing, which can go a little over the top sometimes, shall we say. In terms of the exploration, you are given a goal, obviously get to the top of the mountain. You're not really given any short-term goals. Like, you're largely left to your own devices just to explore this space. And, like, I love a good exploration game, and it's quite organic the way you go about it here. You usually have multiple options as to where you can go. You can quite easily end up in an area that you're not quite ready for, and end up doing a particularly hard part of the game earlier than you were intended to. There's a lot of sequence breaking going on, but it does give this sense of like this organic discovery, like that you're not being forced or literally led through this game. Everything is sort of very diegetic, the way, like, although even the resources, like the various shards and rosary beads that you're collecting as currency, are basically like literally in the game. You kill an enemy, the resources drop to the ground, or you'll find them hanging on these threads you have to destroy. And there's so many destructible environments here that is both just represents like hide secrets, obviously, but also can represent like how this whole world is decaying and falling apart, and how much of it is can be broken down. And that is really satisfying, obviously, both in just hitting things and then breaking, but also finding little secrets. There are secrets everywhere in this game. Sorry, Kat is being particularly urgent again.
Speaking about hitting.
I do really appreciate that this game encourages exploring. Obviously, Metroidvanias, you're obviously wanting to double back to older areas. You just got the jump, the double jump or the dash, and you want to reach that area you couldn't reach before. And I think that what this game really does well is, like in Souls-like games, which I think tonally this game emulates quite a lot, you have these weird little NPC quests where you have to like have gone back to this particular dungeon, or the Swamp Witch will be in this dungeon, but only if you go here between boss X and Y, otherwise she just dies and disappears from the game. And it's so easy to miss all these little triggers in a Souls-like games, because you're not naturally going to be going back and exploring older areas. Whereas Metroidvania games, you're inherently encouraged to do that, to re-explore areas, go through them multiple times, find new things. And this game does both encourage that, but also reward that. You're so often coming across the world states changing. There was a few big surprises. It's like there's various hub towns basically that would change quite dramatically, or like events would happen, not to spoil anything, in some quite surprising ways. And there's this real sense of Hornet just checking in on everyone. Oh, how are you guys doing here? How are you holding up? Is everyone doing okay? Is this town thriving? It's like it feels everything here is better. Everyone is surviving better due to you helping, basically. And that's a really nice sense here. So yeah, I mentioned a little bit about some of the abilities there. You do start off like basically with not very much. You have a sword, you can jump, and you can hit things, and that's about it. It feels at the start of the game like really bare bones. There's very sort of slow paced. You feel very underpowered. It is quite punishing. You're going to be hitting a lot of pain points early on in the game. By the halfway point, you basically feels like, you know, the start of a regular action adventure or Souls-like games. When by the time you've got like, you know, a dash or a jump and a glide and all these abilities that basically you would start most games with, here you have to earn them. And you do really value those when you do unlock them. Obviously, finally, I can run, I can dash. The game feels so much better to move through once you have that, so you value it. But at the same time, they're not the most exciting compared to some other Metroidvanias, like The Lost Crown, which had some really creative and inventive abilities beyond the, you know, the regular, you know, dash, glide type deals. So it's not the most original there, but it does, you know, you do really value them when you get them, I guess.
Yeah, I recall in Lost Crown, the bow and arrow abilities were quite cool, as well as the secondary abilities. I think there was one that sort of created like a healing zone around you, and then some secondary attacks, basically like giving you kind of alts, like alternate modes, I thought was quite compelling.
Yeah, and the other big thing here, obviously, is I seem to recall Hollow Knight, it wasn't necessarily the first game, but it was one of the big innovators in this area, I think they were called charms in that game. Basically, there's little collectibles that change the way you play. And, I mean, traditionally, you basically have a certain number of slots. You might start with 3 slots to, you know, choose which charms you want to activate, and then you might unlock more slots over the course of the game. A lot of games have innovated on that, Lost Crown for one. Silksong does shift that up. You still are finding these charms. I think they're called, what do they call them here? Tools. I think they're called tools here, but they're much more granular. They're split into subcategories, and you can only ever activate like two or three of a particular category. It's much more restrictive into basically making a build for yourself. There's these whole move sets, crests they're called. They're basically new weapons that are not completely different move sets. They might make you attack faster or change the way that you sort of there's this pogo attack that is quite divisive. Because at the start of the game, you pogo diagonally, which is quite unusual. And like the game doesn't even teach you that. Like it is a core mechanic that you have to do to use to navigate this game. There is no tutorial for that. You're just expected to know it and figure it out organically. But there are these quests will change the way that reacts. It will change your whole move set, much like a fighting game character, in ways that are a little opaque. Like there's no move set. You basically have to try them out and just discover what these moves are. But each of these quests have a differing number of slots for these. Whether it's like tools for throwing knives or some of the more passive quests you can activate. So yeah, that was interesting. It was incredibly granular, but it's a little arbitrary. You can't really customize to a great degree. Like if you want to be able to have a regular down pogo, you're going to be stuck with one or two crests and the whatever charms you can activate on that. The charms do let you basically decide what points of friction you want to act on this game, because there are so many points of friction in this game. In a lot of these charms that you basically let you nullify a lot of these points of friction, like, oh, now there's a compass on the map, which a lot of people will you know, think of as mandatory, or now you drop less rosary beads when you die, or now when you're climbing a wall, you don't slide down, you can sort of grip into place. So it can let you decide how you want to interact with this game, obviously, but it's not as customizable as Hollow Knight and some of these other Metroidvanias. You really are stuck with basically this quest system, and some of those are going to feel better than others. So I don't know. I found that a little bit forced. Like I would have a little more granularity in which things I wanted to use. I was having to make some really tough decisions. Obviously, that's a design decision, but so often it was like, if I want to have the compass, if I want to be able to navigate the map, then that negates a whole lot of other more interesting abilities. I was often unable to experiment with these charms because it was so restrictive, you know, only being able to have one or two at a time, basically. And some of the more interesting ones you only get pretty late in the game. So you've already sort of locked into your system, you've already beat most of the game, and it's a bit late to be adding in these new tools that would have been much useful early on. It takes a long time for these to start to unlock, basically.
You know what I was reminded of when you were just talking about clinging to the walls, is that this is just going to be a really small introduction, but I played this kind of ridiculous, kind of really unremarkable Metroidvania game called Shadow Labyrinth. Have you heard about this?
I have heard of it, yes. I've heard it's good,
It is. I mean, it might be good. I've only played a couple of hours of it, but it's essentially like a dark and gritty Pac-Man-themed Metroidvania. Like, Pac-Man is a literal character in this game.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
It's called Puck. And there's a lot of, like, Pac-Man kind of visual references.
And a lot of Bandai Namco throwbacks. What I was reading about that. Yeah.
Right. Of course, it's from Namco, so original creator Pac-Man, so that makes sense. It was pretty unremarkable, except for one ability, which is essentially you turn into Pac-Man. So you become, like, this sort of morph ball who can cling to walls and platforms that have the Pac-Man kind of, like, grid designed to them, so like you have this kind of like neon line and you can essentially follow it, but unlike Pac-Man, you can jump in between these and sort of perform some platforming. You can actually attack as Pac-Man as well. So I thought that was interesting enough to mention, but I don't have an opinion on it yet.
I've heard good things. I just don't have a particular attachment to that franchise. So I don't know if I'd appreciate it as much.
Yeah, weird flashback, a callback for sure.
Okay. So, yeah, back to Silksong. Well, I should probably talk about the combat, which is going to be the big pain point for a lot of people in this game. It is quite difficult combat. One thing I struggled with a lot is that the general attacks are quite tight. The windows in which you're hitting enemies is quite small. You have to be in this quite precise position. It felt a little too tight at times, especially when like they really love throwing enemies at you that float above just out of reach and like pull back constantly. And it's like it's a real crutch in so many of the enemies in this game that I'd never really felt like I had a good tool for. I mean, obviously it's a deliberate choice, but it just was not fun to use with this top very tight attack animation. It was really hard to reach up above. Obviously the pogoing is quite tricky to get a hold of in a combat mechanics. It's quite punishing if you fail that. I eventually did unlock just the simple downwards pogo and have been overutilizing that, perhaps using that as a bit of a crutch, shall we say. But ultimately, Hornet is very much a glass cannon. If you so much as touch an enemy, you take damage. Even it's not just an attack, but if you touch them, you take damage. So many of attacks will do 2 pips of damage, which has been a big issue in the community, which, you know, you start out with 5. Basically health pips, so 2 of those is nearly half your health essentially, so it's very easy to fall into traps here and die quite easily. I mean, just navigating the world, the regular enemies are quite tricky. There are a lot of literal traps in this game. The game is constantly like these little gotcha moments. Obviously, another Souls classic. There are some great surprises and gotcha moments, but sometimes the game is already so punishing when you're deep into in the dungeon and you think you found a bench. Oh, turns out it's not a bench, and then you've got a long walk back. It does revel in those little gotchas a little bit much, I will say. And I've talked about the boss fights being really good, I think, earlier, especially with their attack animations. When I've been having trouble with those boss fights, I've usually realized I'm being too aggressive. If I just stop, hang back for a minute, study their animation pattern, I can usually get a pretty good read on them. Most boss fights I could beat easily with just standing back, watching for the animation, getting a quick hit in, being opportunistic rather than just being super aggressive. So if you are patient and careful in this game, you generally can get a fair way. That said, they do still throw so many tricks at you, like those floating enemies. They love throwing multiple enemies into a boss fight, basically. And there's just so many things on the screen and so many projectiles that it's really hard to track. There's, you know, the classic boss run, basically. If you die, you have to run all the way back from the last save point, which I think is just, at this point, it just feels like an arbitrary point of unnecessary friction. Like, I don't know what it's necessarily adding by making you run through that gauntlet. I've already beat that gauntlet. Making me do that again just to try the boss fight one more time, it's like, perhaps I'm a little bit biased in that I literally, before recording, I am stuck on a particularly hard boss after a particularly long gauntlet, and I just don't have much patience for that anymore. Like, just let me fight the boss. I've already proved that I can do the gauntlet. Why are you making me redo this? There's so many layers of friction in this game that I do think get a little much and just feel arbitrary. Like, it's not a Souls-like game necessarily, but they're playing with that trapping, and I think it's just difficulty for difficulty's sake without having a particularly strong reason for having it there.
Sounds like padding to me.
Yeah, and like, it is already a long game, and I'm 30 hours in. I'm basically, I could go fight the final boss now. I'm doing like the cleanup stage. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm hitting all of the high level, most difficult aspects of this game right now. So that is a particular difficulty point. But if you just focus on the key elements, I think you will have a really good time. Like, there was a good 20 hour stretch where I was having a great time in the middle. The very beginning and end, I think, is where the difficulty is going to hit you the hardest. And I don't think it's always in a particularly satisfying way, I will say. But when you are just in that middle stage exploring for exploration's sake, there's a great sense of discoverability in, like, there's so many little things you interact with. Oh, there's a machine here. It wants 50 rosaries. Are you going to put them in? Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. And again, sometimes it can be a bit of a gotcha, but there is a good sense of discovery and this sort of poking at this world and finding out what it does, the history of this place. This has a really strong sense of place to explore, and I've really enjoyed that. I don't know why it's insisting on this sort of self-flagellation with the difficulty.
All right. Sounds good. I'll probably get to that eventually, but I should play more of the original Hollow Knight before that.
Yeah.
Very cool. Should we move on into dessert?
Excellent. Yes, let's do that.
Okay, I'm going to do a quick one since we're running a bit long.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be talking about manga again, of course, because that's my main thing. This time it's a manga classic. I have kind of gone back to the original, maybe like the original, one of the originals, really genre-defining one called Astro Boy, or also called Tetsuwan Atomu in Japanese, by the legendary Osamu Tezuka. This was serialized in a shonen manga from 1952 to 1968, so that's a remarkably long time. Think about it, 16 years, and sort of has been renewed and refreshed multiple times. But I'm reading volume 1 and 2, published in North America by Dark Horse Comics, and this mostly has like hand-selected chapters from 1960 through 1962. So they don't seem to be doing it in order, but nonetheless, it's still pretty interesting. And it's kind of remarkable. So Tezuka created a number of series. Astro Boy is probably the most famous, but he also created Blackjack, Kimba the White Lion. Some of those have been translated into English as well. And actually, Blackjack and Astro Boy were featured prominently at the Osaka Expo in 2025, where I visited in one of the pavilions there as well. So his spirit is live and strong. It was also a breakout hit. The first animated series in 1963 was a huge hit in North America, maybe one of the first anime to really cross over. This was around the sort of time of like Speed Racer and things like that too, as well, 1960s. Okay, so this is a really early manga, but it's also, you know, squarely shonen. So it kind of follows a lot of the tropes, but it also kind of sets a lot of the tropes as well. First of all, it's remarkable to read because it's like so firmly set in the Cold War period.
Mm-hmm.
And the space race is obviously a really strong theme in this because like 1960, you know, like this is when the space race is really heating up. Obviously, Atomu, Adam, the robot is named after the atomic bomb, which was dropped on Japan like 20 years previous, so, or 15 years previous, really. So it's not that
still pretty
far in memory. Yeah. But there's a strong sense of optimism in this. Obviously, it's set in its future, which is set in our past. It's kind of sort of alternate history here. And the world's really interesting. The creator, Tezuka, has imagined a future where robots are considered equal to humans, at least in human rights. So I think one chapter goes so far as to say the population of Earth is at least half human and half robot. They have the same rights as humans do. They have a right to personhood. They have right to self-determination. Like these are things that they're struggled with in things like American sci-fi, like that AI movie with Haley Joel Osment, right? Like they couldn't imagine that robots could be thought of as having civil rights. Of course, this manga was coming up in the early stages of the civil rights movement as well. So there's a lot of heavier themes in this. It's really interesting. I was kind of shocked by how thought-provoking some of the story arcs were. Like, first of all, like there are story arcs that run many chapters, and they're really quite involved. Like some of these are more intriguing and well-developed than some of the shonen stuff that comes out today. So it's really remarkable for such an early stage. That said, it also has one foot set in the like slapstick comedy of previous generation. You know, you got your Betty Boops and things like that, and your Steamboat Willies. It's remarkable seeing that visual style, that ancient visual style, with some of these more headier topics. Like you got the concept of, machines with souls, cybernetics, you know, the rights of AI, civil disobedience, like authoritarianism. These are the themes that they cover in much, much later work, like Akira and Ghost in the Shell. But this guy was covering it back then in 1960, which was like obviously over 50 years ago. It's remarkable. And so just really groundbreaking work. Really interesting to see. I have also been reading some of the like the later material, like Pluto and Atom, the Beginning, which are based on this material. So I thought, you know, I should really kind of go back and read the basics and find out where this is all rooted from. And it's really like super naive stuff. Like they're talking about how the super powerful robots have like vacuum tubes and things like that in them. Obviously they could not, to be practical, practically speaking, but it's just a view into a different time, but still well worth reading. And it's really cool that it's available. I got it digitally from Libby. You can just download that on your Libby app, or of course find the trade paperbacks in the library or comic book store.
Gotta love that retro sci-fi where just anything is possible.
Yeah, very much like the Jetsons feel, but even from before that.
Yeah,
it's quite cool stuff. Anyways, well worth reading. I enjoyed it.
Cool. Speaking of classic comics with heavy themes, I don't know if it's exactly a recommendation, but what I have been reading is V for Vendetta. So this is the comic by Alan Moore and art by David Lloyd. I've been following along with the Shelf by Genre podcast, which I've mentioned multiple times before, but it was a good excuse to finally check this out. The film was a long-time favorite of mine. But, I mean, that came out in like 2005-ish, I want to say. And I don't know if it partly was just, you know, childhood innocence or the times being very different. It's a very different read in 2025 than in 2005, shall we say. It hits a little different now. Obviously, it's a, you know, written in the 80s, but it's very much a, you know, fascist uprising like your 1984 and sort of anarchist rebellion against that. And so I don't know exactly what the message of this book is. It's like, it's obviously fascism is bad, but it's not necessarily anarchy is good either. There's not really a clean answer there. It really makes you think though. It's not, I don't love the way it wraps up. They does have some pretty awful treatment of women in this comic, I will say. And it gets a bit little messy in just the showing how this sort of fascist party collapses and basically how it all collapses in petty squabbles, perhaps in ways that might ring a little true, but just the way it played out in the book was a little messy. It didn't have a really clean through line there, but it was, it's incredibly provoking, shall we say. V as a sort of anti-hero is just so, he's really jokeified in a sense, like this is flair for the dramatic and everything has to be a big show and symbol, obviously. So it's fascinating read. I don't know exactly what I'm drawing from it just yet. I have to spend some time pondering on that, but it's interesting in these, it's an incredibly difficult time right now, obviously. And it's great to see them exploring these sort of systematic issues rather than just, you know, take out the man at the top, like something like, you know, Metaphor Fantasio, which we mentioned recently. You know, these systematic issues go a lot deeper. It takes a lot more to address them, essentially. So yeah, it's a classic for good reason. It's not without its faults, but worth checking out.
Yeah, we're following through with the theme of the podcast, which is reviewing old material, brushing, polishing off some old gems. They're not all perfect, obviously, but well worth studying to gain new lessons from.
Yeah, exactly. It's fascinating as a historical piece, basically, at this point, you know, over 40 years old. So that's three courses of games right there. So yeah, thanks everyone for listening. If you have any questions or comments on today's games or any recommendations that we should look into, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
Yep. You can also find us on YouTube. We post videos of our episodes there. Our older episodes were only in audio form, so go seek those out on a podcatcher of your choosing. We'd love to hear your feedback on either platform. Send us comments. It really energizes us and gives us reason to keep going. Of course, we don't charge for this podcast. We do it out of love. Always want to hear from other members of the club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really tough to get discoverability out there right now, I will say, in the podcast realm. So any help you can do to spread the word, tell your friends, share a link on Blue Sky, is always appreciated. You can find us on Blue Sky at omnigamers.club and myself at Board Game Feast.
Right, and I am Mark Uasa, MarkYuasa, at bsky.com.
Excellent.
All right, any other plugs you want to give, Daniel?
I'm excited to check out the Vancouver Game Garden in just a couple of weeks.
Right, and I saw that you were talking a little bit about TCTC rebranding there, so excited.
Yeah, go check that out. There's some exciting news with how that's coming together. Big plans for the next year of Terminal City, yeah.
Very cool. Lots of exciting stuff coming up. Well, thanks again, folks, for listening, and next time, I hope you have a balanced diet of games.
Thanks.
Bye.